So, where are we?
Talk about the body armor.
Yeah, remember some of the striking things that, that occurred during those tests. Seeing a Navy lieutenant hold a 8-inch panel of this body armor, which was rigid, on his hand, and catch a 45 caliber bullet in the body armor, bruised his hand a little bit. But he nevertheless, as a demonstration of the effectiveness of it, would do that. And of course it was used to check out, I think they used sheep and goats to check the effect on.
Was it used in helmets?
No, it wasn't used in helmets. Matter of fact, this development came later in the war, and it was used actually for body armor, like vests, or flak sheets in airplanes. They would hang it in sheets and protect personnel and or material in airplanes. And it was the forerunner of the bulletproof vests that the police wear these days. Their variation on that theme.
How long did this pass the war? Was production continued? Was much of that curtailed when the war ended?
In general, things came to pretty much of a screeching halt because everybody was working on war material things. For example, a good example was the number of people that were working on the proximity fuse. We were right in the middle of the proximity fuse work. And there was just no use for that fuse once the war was over, so they had to find other things to do. But there were a number of molders around the country that were deeply involved in the proximity fuse development. It was a very successful epicellulose development. And was the most devastating, we talked to the Germans later, was the most devastating of any of the weapons that the Germans encountered. The reason being that, are you familiar with what I'm talking about, a proximity fuse?
Very vaguely.
All right. What this is a small radar set that sends out a signal, reflects the signal back, and tells you how far you are away from an object. So when you shoot a shell, you could shoot it, lob it over, have it come down, and have it fire above the ground instead of hitting the ground and then firing. And the effect was it made foxholes worthless. You no longer were protected in a foxhole like you would be if it hit the ground and then exploded. From above, it exploded and just covered the foxholes, and it was devastating. It really was a major factor in the ultimate solution of the Battle of the Bulge.
You said you were right in the middle of that. Now, what way were you in the middle?
Material.
Okay.
We were... A number of us had... secret clearances, of course. And yet, we went for quite a period of time, when we were asked to supply materials with certain kinds of loading without knowing what the element use was. So we really didn't know what we were trying to accomplish by the loading. And that went on for quite a while until... One time I was in Washington, and I called up a chap that was in charge of development of proximity fuses and told him, look, if you're expecting us to be very much help to you, we're going to have to know more than we know about what we're doing. I didn't mention the proximity fuse. And he said, well, we're very restricted in this, and he went on and all sort of things. And I said, well, I know you are, but I have seen this operation several times in different molders plants where it's very clear what this is all about. And he was quite shocked that the secrecy was this loose. So we got our secrecy clearances and were able then to work directly with the people and trying to improve the electrical characteristics of the Palmer so that it would be a good radar transmitter and receiver.
Well, I think this brings us to your European trip in 1945.
Yeah, early in 1945, or maybe even late in 1944, I'm not quite sure which, we received a letter from General Durio. I received a letter from General Durio stating that the war was coming to an end, hopefully, and that it was a good opportunity to observe what the Germans were doing in way of plastic applications, polymer applications, as well as polymer manufacturing. And would I be interested in joining with a group to undertake an investigation of this industry? And I was thrilled at the idea. And I then found out that John DeBell and Walter Gluer had, whom I knew from contacts in the plastics industry and with Quartermaster Corps, that they had received similar letters and were asked to consider the same thing. And so I enthusiastically replied that I would definitely be interested in doing that. We could arrange things to get away and all that sort of thing. So that was the start of it.
Do you know how he picked your name?
Well, probably just as a result of the number of contacts that we had with the Quartermaster Corps and the way the developments had gone. We'd had a number of good developments with the Quartermaster Corps. I don't recall them all, but screening and plastic canteens, helmet liners, things like that that worked out very well. So that, along with, he was guided in this to some extent by Major Hobson, Ed Hobson.
I think his picture's in the...
Yeah, it is. Hobson was given the direct responsibility of being the liaison man with the team back in the Quartermaster Corps of the United States.
When did you leave for Europe, do you recall?
After we finally got outfitted and everything, we left. It must have been early May 1945. The war was just finishing. I think we left before the armistice, which is, May the...
8th, I think.
8th or 10th or something like that. We left just about that time and arrived. Well, we flew directly from Washington to Stevensville, and from Stevensville, I believe, right directly to Paris, going around several hot spots that still were shooting war was going on in Belgium and parts of France, landing in Paris, getting acquainted, moved to a billet in Montmartre, which was kind of interesting. Anyway, then we knew that the occupational areas were pretty well defined, and that the Russians were not up to their line. Are you familiar with this? Okay.
Well, go ahead, though.
Yeah. that Patton had overrun the area that he had, he was assigned to, and pushed the Russians, or pushed the other folks quite far back, met the Russians way east at the Elbe. And this area that he had occupied included a number of very important chemical and plastic plants. So we knew that the Russians would be moving back in there sooner or later. And we also knew that when they did, it would be very difficult for us to get at these plants and the scientists that were located there. So we immediately proceeded to move to East Germany to occupy those areas. And many of the pictures that we have, or many of the things that we did, were had to do with the plants of Wolfen, Leuna, Schkopau, and Bitterfeld, four major chemical plants, each dependent on the other, with Leuna as the basic plant. Okay. So, and there were 80,000 employees in those plants during the height of their occupation. For chemical plants, that's quite a sizable gang. Yeah. Just a second, let me get the book. This isn't organized on the basis of travels going here and there, but rather pulling together different basic materials. But here, for example, were samples of pictures at Wolfen. And well, these are Wolfen, but they're Bitterfeld pictures are out here.
How badly damaged were these plants?
Well, this was an interesting thing. The plants of Schkopau, Leuna, Schkopau, Bitterfeld, and Wolfen were not badly damaged. But the Leuna plant, which was the basic supply plant, was completely knocked out. It was knocked out 90%. So, and it just couldn't feed the other plants, so they all went down. This was a programmed bombing of the Allies that did this. And it was very effective, the way they went about it. They really blasted Leuna.
You're just looking at some of these pictures. You can see that
Well, these don't show that much damage.
No, but I mean,
there are ones that show a lot of them.
Were you the photographer?
I was a photographer. I took like something like 900 pictures. I lost my exposure meter the first day we hit Germany. So all this was done without an exposure meter.
Well, you had enough experience.
Yeah.
I
began to have some experience, that's right. Won't blur. But there are a lot of pictures. It was a fascinating trip. You couldn't help but respect the Germans for what they had done. It was true, though, that if Hitler had allowed them to carry on with their development to follow up on their research, they would have been a lot farther along in the war. But they had to spend so much time on fuel for jet fighters and then later jet fighters that they put everything into production and not move the new developments into production, just the old ones to keep them going.
I have a number of questions come to mind with it. How were their scientists when you went into these areas? The American troops had definitely just been there a short time before. You were very
well. They were right there at the same time.
So they accompanied you.
We were dependent on the American troops for supplies and billeting and all that sort of thing.
Okay. How cooperative were the Germans when you talked to them?
In general, they were very cooperative. There were two things. They were very proud of what they did, and rightly so. But in addition to that, they knew that that we had the power of authority over them and could have put them in jail without any trouble if we felt they weren't cooperating. So we found a relatively small percentage of the German scientists that were all negative about cooperating with us or about telling us where to go next to see Joe Blow, who's a great developer of this new material, that sort of thing. We had very good cooperation there, and that's the way we got around, was leads from one to the next to the next, and so on. Because a lot of these folks we didn't know, and a lot of things that they were doing we didn't know about, nor did the Allies know about them. As it's mentioned here in the book, there are quite a few new things that we found that we knew nothing about, especially things like isocyanates. And
I was going to ask if there are any real big surprises.
I'd say the isocyanates were a big surprise. And some of their, for example, these tremendous dryers were quite some developments, too. Here we list some of the outstanding things. Caprolactam and synthetic fire material. Magnetic iron oxide film for plastic tape recording was brand new. Wasn't known in this country at all. Yeah. And yet they were using it in the battleground.
Really?
Yeah. And this is Hobson.
Yes, that's the picture I remember.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you there?
We were there from early May until, if I recall correctly, well into September. And we were traveling all the time. We had our own weapons carrier and men assigned to us. We figured we'd travel about 10,000 miles throughout Germany, just going back and forth all over the whole cotton-picking place. Well-received practically everywhere we went.
I was going to ask you about you talked about the scientists, what about the German people that you interacted with?
They were very frightened of us, generally speaking, just as they were the soldiers. We had our own rations. We'd sea rations. Are you familiar with Army rations at all?
A little bit.
Okay. Sea rations, which were pretty good. And we'd be traveling fairly late some nights, not getting back to where we wanted to go. And we'd pick out a German country house, stop in and asked us if we could come in and warm up our food. And they'd be pretty frightened at first, and then they'd warm up as we offered them food from our rations and become quite friendly. It was a fun experience.
Were you in Berlin?
I was not in Berlin. No, as a matter of fact, John wasn't either. He later went back to Berlin, but there was nothing really very much for us in Berlin except just to say we'd been there.
Now, you said you got information of other areas from people that you talked to. What types of plants were you looking for? Were you looking strictly for chemical plants, all chemical plants, or just specific kinds?
No, we were looking for those plants. Those chemical plants that had anything to do with polymers, rubbers, foams, any of the polymeric type materials, including monomer plants that would supply them. So this book covers those monomers right on through to the plastic applications. That was our responsibility, to cover everything from monomers right on through to plastic applications. With not so much emphasis on rubbers, except as they would be used for plastic-type applications, because there was another rubber team that was really doing a synthetic rubber activity there. So we didn't spend much time on synthetic rubber plants. We were interested very much in things like styrene production, butadiene production, or vinyl chloride, or other material production like that, polyethylene, as it relates to polyethylene.
I had, on Monday, I had talked to Dr. Mohlweiler from Abbott Labs, who had been in Germany as part of a team investigating the pharmaceutical plant.
That's right.
We talked about his experiences there.
He'd had quite some experiences too, hadn't he?
Yes, yes. Yeah. But he was not in, he was in later, so. Mm-hmm.
He probably didn't get a chance to get in some of these Russian plant areas then.
No.
They were pretty rigid about.
Did you manage to cover those areas before the Russians came back in?
Oh, yes, that's what we did. That's these plants that I speak of, the Wolfen, Skopau, Bitterfeld, Leuna plants, are all in the Russian territory, not near Leipzig, sort of surrounding the city of Leipzig.
Okay.
And that was the biggest single concentration of plants, other than old Ludwigshafen and a few places like that. But we managed to cover them thoroughly before the Russians were allowed in there. And guys like, we didn't have anything to do with this, but the pure military people from the Chemical Warfare Service would arrange to get the scientists out and to get the key equipment out as insofar as possible before the Russians moved in, and did quite a job of doing that. The Russians, people that saw these plants later, said they just didn't understand how to operate them. It was sort of a mess.
Did you see any of the Russians, or were you gone before that?
Oh, no. We ran into the Russians and got into the Russian territory in a few plants. But it was a great struggle. We did it more or less to see if we could do it. And we did get across and get into some Russian plants that were on the other side of the Elbe. They were German plants, but they're in Russian territory. Yeah.
Had the Russians already had scientists in Europe?
No.
Did they have counterparts?
No, they didn't. They hadn't had, as far as we could tell, they hadn't had any counterparts in. And people that we interviewed in the Russian plant areas had not been previously interviewed by anybody other than just regular military.
I see. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So then the United States did manage to. Did any of these scientists come to the United States then as a result of this?
Well, many of them visited the United States later. We've had many of them here in Midland. Became good friends. But I don't know of any case where, except for the rocket people, Werner von Braun and his gang, there are a lot of those folks that they moved right to the United States and put into development things here. But I don't know of any of the Germans that came over and became employees. With maybe the exception of Roman Haas, which was, of course, pretty much a German... related plant anyway. They may have had some people there.
Did any of this information help you when you got back to Dow?
Well, I naturally was very interested in some of these things which are new to us. We'd like to see them. For example, I would like to see Dow interested in isocyanate chemistry. But in spite of the fact that we were in Annalen, nitrogen chemistry, Dr. Veazey would have no part of it. He didn't want anything to do with it. I don't think he knew anything about it, but he just didn't want to even consider any possibilities. There were some possibilities in the in the cellulosic area where we were dealing with methylcellulose. They had gone a lot farther in the production of carboxymethylcellulose than we had. And some of those things were interesting. And some of the things in vinyl chloride and styrene.
What happened to some of this equipment that you said was removed from the plants in the Russian area before the Russians came? Yes.
It was moved back to German plants, West German plants, and there were some pieces, smaller pieces of equipment that were shipped to the United States.
Do you know what happened to them in this country then?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure that the full advantage of was taken of a lot of the stuff that came back. In spite of the fact that I think we published the most comprehensive book of any of the teams that were there.
Extremely thorough. There's no doubt.
Yeah, it's got everything in it that we picked up, that's for sure.
Now, you mentioned to me earlier, and we had talked about this earlier, that you have a collection of material relating to this particular event.
Yeah, do you want to take a break for a minute?
No. Okay, sure.
We'll take a look at...
Yes, I had asked him about that, but outside of... I think he said he did a lot of traveling.
Yeah, he did.
It was in Washington quite a bit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he really didn't give me too much additional information beyond that. That brings us to the post-war period, and I think that the name Plastics Technical Service probably settled down as the proper name at that point.
Yeah, it did. It did. That happened fairly early. The other name was too cumbersome and just didn't work out too well. You've got everything you think you want on the book, and then...
Yes, I think we've discussed that, and knowing that you have all of that original information.
Yeah. Do you have copies of the book?
There's a copy in the Smith Collection at the center, yes.
Okay.
I did take a look at that before I came.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are more stories about the trip.
Just all sorts of stories.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add about that before we move on?
No, the chap with the, of course, have your folks talked to Walt Bluer?
I think somebody's been in contact with him.
Yeah.
I don't know if
if you're really interested in this, you should talk to John DeBell.
Okay.
John DeBell will have the most vivid memory of any of us, I think. In spite of the fact that I don't know how old he is, he must be 90. Mm. But he's a real spry for his age. He's very peppy.
Where is he located?
Longmeadow, Massachusetts.
Okay.
If you want his exact address, I think I could get it for you.
Okay, when we're finished, maybe we can.
All right.
I know we have been in touch with Bluer, but I'll follow up on that as well. If we can talk to DeBell about it, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand how far you want to go. When it comes right down to it, I'm not very much of a chemist. And why you want my stuff, I'm not...
You were in the Plastic Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah.
You've given some already the information on that student training program at Dow. Well,
that sort of thing is valuable as far as you're concerned.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, you have come into polymers from a different viewpoint, but I think it's also important. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk.
Yeah.
About.